Miss Gwaradzimba, many congratulations for landing such a top position at the United Nations. How do you feel?
Well, I'm thrilled. I'm extremely, extremely thrilled, and I feel very privileged and honored. It's been a long time since I joined the United Nations, and I never expected that I would get to this level, and I feel extremely honored.
And looking at it, you are one of the very few African women that we know at the UN and other top international organizations who have made it to such levels. What are your peers saying, and your family, how do they feel, and yourself in terms of that recognition that you have been given by Mr. Ban Ki-moon?
I think a lot of people, I mean, starting with my family, they are very, very honored. They are pleased and excited for me. And I got calls from even distant family members I haven't heard from in a long time. And they are all just elated by that. And my peers and friends, they are extremely supportive. They are also saying that it's an honor and a recognition of the professionalism and the commitment that you have shown to your career, but also in particular in working for the United Nations values. So I'm very pleased with that.
What are you bringing to the table as the Assistant Secretary General for Safety and Security to help tackle the crisis in the world today? For example, we have the Syrian crisis, problems in the Central African Republic, Burkina Faso, Afghanistan, and also in particular reference to Zimbabwe, your country, and the issues that it has been going through over the past few years, a decade or so.
Yes. Well, the thing is, of course, the United Nations Department of Safety and Security deals with ensuring the safety of all United Nations staff, irrespective of the situation in the country. That task is much harder and more challenging in conflict countries, as you have mentioned, and there are a lot of those. So the job that I'm going into is to help contribute to ensuring the safety of the staff. In terms of resolving the conflict, of course, the parties to the conflict, the Secretary General, and all the other parties have to work on that. What we know is that when you are in the conflict zones, the duty of ensuring that you're carrying on the United Nations work is far more complex. Therefore, the protection of those staff, ensuring that they have the humanitarian space, the development space to do the work that is needed in those situations is fundamental. And working with the host government is very important because they're at the front and center of protecting those staff. So what I bring is really a very keen understanding of the work of the United Nations across the board. I've been with the United Nations Development Program, the development arm of the United Nations, for over 25 years. I have also worked in peacekeeping operations with the United Nations in Kosovo, et cetera, and covered Asia and Southwest Asia with critical countries like Pakistan, Afghanistan, Nepal, all that went through conflict. So my keen understanding and awareness of what happens on the ground when the United Nations is there, I think will help me a lot to bring added value to the work of UNDSS.
Working in the field at that particular time or through all these years that you have been working for the UN, going into the field, can you just explain to the person who's listening what it entails? What is it like to be working in a conflict zone?
Working in a conflict zone requires that first and foremost, you have to ensure that you as the person carrying the mandate of your agency of the United Nations are safe enough to do it. There is risk involved. But what is acceptable risk? So it means going in there with security officers who are protecting, with armored vehicles that are there to, you know, ward off any explosive or any dangerous things that might happen, to be alert all the time and to check in with the security people, the experts who will tell you it's safe to go to area A, to area B, etc. So at any time, being alert, being aware, and coordinating with the governments and other NGOs on the ground is extremely important. And for example, if one is the resident coordinator of the United Nations system, who answers to the Secretary General and the head of the agency, it is important to ensure that you are aware of how many staff are on the ground, where are they at any time, are there families in country if the situation is not as drastic, because in other countries, families cannot join their spouses or their families if the place is too dangerous. So that element, and also ensuring that if there is a humanitarian crisis, you are speaking to those issues and finding out what is happening on the ground to protect the population, is extremely important so that the Secretary General is kept informed at all times. And this work, of course, depends on the mandate of each agency. For example, OCHA does humanitarian work, UNICEF looking after children and also including in conflict, and United Nations Development Program, ensuring that where there is development space, development work should not be compromised, and we should continue to work on those issues because poverty, women's issues become even more acute in conflict situations.
Just going back to, you know, to Zimbabwe, you grew up and got your first degree in a patriarchal Zimbabwean society. How did you make it, especially as a mother now that you, you know, you are where you are? How difficult has it been to get to where you are, and what really inspires you to keep going?
Yes, you're right. I grew up in not only in a patriarchal society, but in a society where there was institutionalized racism before the independence of Zimbabwe in 1980. And I owe a great deal of my success and the person who I am actually to my father. My late father, who died in 2009, was an incredible man, a simple school teacher and highly religious man who did everything. The way he raised us, the girls, I never felt different from my brother. He raised me as a human being, as a person, and his words to me were always, "You're smart. I am not a rich man, I'm a poor man, but I am wealthy in terms of my brain, and the legacy that I give you, your inheritance is your brain. You use it, and you go to school, and you succeed, and there's nothing that you cannot do." And I think I was so shocked when I went out of that cocoon of protection of family to the outside world to realize how patriarchy and, you know, gender discrimination was so strong. I was lucky also that he sent me to a boarding school. I went to boarding school at Asha, very young, at about 11 years old, and it was an all-girls school. I thrived. I never really saw myself as a girl with less than or needing to, but only when I entered the work world and realized, oh, my goodness, gender relations are difficult, racism is difficult, but because I had been raised with confidence, self-confidence, it was much easier for me to fight. I became a fighter from within, and that strength has been very important, and my father inspired me a lot in terms of, with very little, he did so much, and he made me feel, you know, this is it. So I was always sure of what I wanted to do. I never dreamt, when I grow up, I want to be a mom. At first, I would say, when I grow up, I want to be a poet, or I want to be a writer. And then I said, I wanted to travel the world and do this. And so those dreams were fundamental. And being a mother, being married, was incidental. And when I got married, where I wanted to go, if I met someone who didn't understand where I wanted to go, they were not worth of my time. So I have been lucky in that I got married to someone who understood me and was very supportive and has been and continues to be supportive. And when I had my daughter, I was working actually at that time at the University of Zimbabwe. I have to say I was lucky because I had a job which allows you a little bit of work-life balance. I could take my baby in the bus net to my lectures and leave them there and teach while I'm, you know, still being a mother. And they were, you know, academic holidays where you can spend more time with family. Not many women have that. So you do need childcare. You do need a government that has laws that protect parenting and allows for the facility and subsidies to allow women at every level to be able to afford childcare so they can pursue their dreams and their career aspirations.
Let me ask you, as a Zimbabwean woman, what does your role at the UN mean for your fellow Zimbabwean?
I don't know. I would hope that, you know, of course, I was talking about this with my husband, and I was saying, you know, one of the things that is so important, and my sisters, is that, you know, one is a role model, whether they like it or not. I have benefited from looking at role model, my peers, those above me and those coming below me. And I thought to myself, well, one day some Zimbabwean, you know, young woman or young girl out there in Binga or wherever will look up and say, I want to work for the United Nations. Well, let me see. Google it. And she will find that there has been a Zimbabwean woman who is there at the top. And so that possibility, that credibility gap becomes narrower. She thinks, yes, I can do this. So-and-so has done it. And maybe they can link up with me and talk to me about what they want to do. So I think that my fellow Zimbabwean women will be and should be pleased, and hopefully they will also be cheering me on.
What advice would you give to them, those who are in and outside the UN, who dream of one day, you know, breaking that glass ceiling?
I think the advice I have is one has to have passion for what they want to do and stay the course. There are going to be a lot of obstacles on the way. They can be friends saying, oh, it's not done, you cannot do it. It can be cultural or tradition, as you rightly mentioned. We have a very patriarchal society traditionally. And I think being different, people shouldn't worry about being different. Step a little bit outside of the box and do what your heart tells you. Listen to that inner drama. That is who you are, and that is what is going to carry you through all the institutional or social barriers. And I can't stress enough that excellence is so important. You have to be good at what you do, and you have to be 150% better. And that goes for all women. They have to work harder. They are looked at very differently, you know. Society is not there yet in terms of we're on par with men. And therefore, as a woman, put your best foot forward, always be prepared and work hard and focus on what you want to do. And, of course, network and ask for help, because people can only say no. So there is no need to fear asking for help. It doesn't show weakness. It actually shows strength. And that has helped me a lot also in my career.
Let's talk about mentors. Did you have one when you were, you know, climbing that ladder who encouraged you to keep going when the going got tougher? And are you willing to be a mentor to other women who are looking up to you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As I said, there have been mentors for up, you know, above me and below me and, you know, within the same peer group. And I have had wonderful mentors. Some of them were my bosses. I can mention even the ones that I had at school at this ASHA. There was a woman, I think she was called Mrs. Mutsairo, the first woman who had a university degree. I used to look at her. I never talked to her, and I would think, well, I want to be that woman one day. That's another way of mentoring people, by role modeling. And I had another teacher, Mrs. Esaguli, a woman of four kids on her own, and she taught us science, and she just inspired me so much into saying, I want to be with that, like that woman, smart, dynamic, and on the go. And in my current work, I mean, I've had many mentors. I had a woman called Mrs. Chinnery Hersey. She was the Deputy Secretary General in ILO and has been the advisor to the former president, not the current Ghanaian president. Wonderful woman who taught me a lot in terms of how you hold yourself, how you conduct yourself within the UN business. And those women have been tremendously important to me in terms of, you know, what you can do for yourself and how you can carry on, even as you say, the going is tough.
Lastly, I know, you know, there could be diplomatic issues, but your voice is obviously one that can be used to effect change as a top diplomat. And so looking at your country of birth, Zimbabwe, which for the past decade has been going through a lot of political and economic problems, do you have advice for the leaders in that country and others, you know, on what they could do, you know, going forward?
Well, let me put it this way, Sandra. Having lived outside of Zimbabwe for nearly 30 years now, it would be really presumptuous of me to say to the leaders, this is what you should do. But more fundamentally, of course, as a UN official, I am not allowed to comment on the politics, economics, et cetera, of member state nations. And therefore, this time I would decline to say anything. I love Zimbabwe very, very much, and I wanted to succeed. And I think tapping into the young talent that I see, I mean, yesterday I was just looking at this play, which is by Danai Gurira, who is a Zimbabwean young woman who is best here. I've watched, you know, Rujeko Dumbujena dance and Tendai Mambo, you know, also in Fela. And I think there's a huge talent out there. And if we can tap into that and the next generation takes the baton and carries it forward, I think there's a lot that could happen that would be very positive in that country.